warm. I'll come to Chicago all winter long because, oh my gosh, it's been the best weather. It's fantastic. So let's get spiritual. We're going to talk about spirituality and particularly how we promote spirituality, not only amongst ourselves, but more importantly among the next generations. And I apologize, I'm going to follow the source sheets not exactly. So at times I'll point to things there, but they're also there kind of for your edification. The word spirituality itself comes from the Latin word spiritus, which actually means breath. Spirit is life. It's life-giving, and leading a spiritual life is an important health-promoting, mental health and physical health-promoting process. There are many different ways we can think about and define spirituality, but I want to make a distinction between spirituality and religious observance. They are related, but they're by no means the same thing. One definition of spirituality is that it's the way of being that includes the capacity of humans to see beyond themselves, to become more than they are, to see mystery and wonder in the world around them, to experience private and collective moments of awe, wonder, and transcendence. With that definition of spirituality, it is a universal, but to some extent a private, personal phenomena. There's no one face or form that it takes. And I can't look at you in a moment and say, you're being spiritual right now. Oh, I can see. You're not being very spiritual right now. Because it's such an internal experience. Believe it or not, it is a universal phenomena. Every single culture has some concept of a transcendent, sacred, or divine force. Cultures have enormous differences in that. And religions evolve or predate spirituality, depending on which culture you're talking about, as a way to help individuals grapple with the core existential questions like finding purpose and meaning in life. So that's spirituality. What's religiousness? If spirituality is very private and personal, religiousness is to some extent public and communal. It's the acceptance of a prescribed set of beliefs, customs, and practices that usually attach to some belief in a supreme being, but have to do with very human behaviors and visible practices. And that's usually accompanied by participating in some communal acts of worship. So religion is something we can see. We can point to someone and say, now there's a religious person. There's a person who engages in religious acts, but we can't tell what their spiritual core is like. Unfortunately, a lot of our struggles, particularly with young people, tends to focus around the external trappings, the religious piece. And I remember the first time, we have three sons, we're blessed with three wonderful sons. The baby is now in Shana Bet in Israel, but we've gone through the process with three children going off to Israel for the wonderful gift of a year of study and growth in both religious observance and their own spirituality. And I remember when our first son was there visiting him in the middle of the year, and we were noting how different all the boys that we had watched grow up from the age of two, and we had seen them go off on a plane to Israel, we were noting to our son how different they all look. This one has payas, that one's wearing a hat, this one tzitzis are flying, that one who we never saw in a shul is chuckling, you know, you could hook up electronic equipment to him. He could power Yerushalayim with the shuckling. And as we were talking about this to our son, he said to us, very spiritual young man, what difference does it matter? What you're noticing the wrong things. You're noticing the outside things. So this one wears longer tzitzis, or this one has a tchelet, or this one. That's not who they are. That's not what tells you where somebody is and what their spiritual grounding is. And it was a very telling and important lesson to me. To us in particular, we stopped asking our son to cut his hair, which was, you know, longer than my sheitel. You know, we stopped focusing on whether or not the tzitzis were in or out, and realized that the development that was happening was within, and it was something that we might not see. We just hoped that he would share it with us when it happened, and thank God he did. What does psychology and developmental psychology and research about adolescent growth, child growth, tell us? How can it inform our understandings? I'm here not as a rabbinic scholar, but I'm a psychologist by trade. So I'll defer to the Rav to share with us more rabbinic understandings, but let me share with you from my field what we know about how children grow and learn. We know, by the way, that children are innately searchers. They're seekers. They look for understandings and meaning. And in a way, they're extraordinarily open to transcendent and awesome experiences. But at exactly the time that we are looking to cement their religious identity, spirituality decreases. There is a natural decline in religious commitment and in external religious observance through middle adolescence. In late adolescence, teens become much more open to mentors and models. It's why, by the way, my colleague Dr. Pelkovitz has done this study on the year in Israel. I actually have another small study on parents' responses to their children's year in Israel, which I can share some of the outcomes with you later on. But it's why the year in Israel is so powerful. And it's why when we scratch our heads and we all say, well, we paid all that tuition to high school. Why didn't they hop it in high school? What do I need another year? More money? Why couldn't I? It's because the openness to those kinds of models is different in an 18-year-old than it is in a 14-year-old. It's just part of the developmental process. We also understand very clearly from cognitive psychology, the theoreticians that go back as far as Piaget and Vygotsky, that children's learning and their brains and their ability to understand abstract concepts changes over time. So that very young children have unbelievable magical thinking. They are incredibly concrete. I once told my young children when I was very upset or frustrated about something, oh, I could just jump out of my skin. And one of them said, you can do that? Doesn't it come with you when you do that? So that their ability to hear Medrash, to hear the Parsha about the Kriyat Yamsuf this Shabbat, they have no problem suspending any question of science or reality and envisioning themselves. They're great for Pesach. They don't have to work to see themselves as if they experience Yetziat Mitzrayim. They live experiencing everything they read as if it's real and true and valid. Their concreteness, coupled with this magical ability to just see the world in huge images, broad brush strokes, and fairy tales, makes them incredibly sensitive and receptive canvases for our spiritual painting. Once children get to school age and develop what's called formal operations and they're able to think on a more abstract level, they're able to problem solve, they're able to question why 2 + 2 = 4, those same cognitive abilities makes them less likely to buy everything we're going to tell them in Parshat HaShavua and everything we're going to tell them about believe in God. Well, how can I believe in God when these terrible things happen? They're going to start having bigger questions and logical conundrums because their brains can handle that kind of reasoning and logic. And as we move to adolescence, we not only get a brain that is approaching and cognitive abilities that are approaching adulthood, not there yet, anyone who has teenagers knows, that the part of the brain that is the last to develop is right up here, the frontal lobes. It's the part of the brain that controls decision-making, reasoning, modulation of mood. Do you get it? You know, why? David Pelkovitz also says that adolescents are the adult brain not yet fully online. Yeah. You know, it's not totally operational yet because it's missing that filter and that reasoning piece. But what comes along in the cognitive boost that happens in late childhood and early adolescence is a drive for independent thinking. I don't want to be spoon-fed. I want to figure it out myself. And that means that authority figures are going to get challenged, and religion as the ultimate authority is going to be subject to challenge. At the same time, not in the cognitive, but in the social realm, what happens as children go into adolescence? The peer group becomes critical, and the need for acceptance of one by one's peers becomes really important. And so, if I am looking around and seeing everybody's wearing a particular type of kippah or everyone's skirts have gotten longer, then I may feel the pressure to do so. Or if I feel on a spiritual level, I want to be davening in a different way, I want to be learning, but nobody else is doing it, then I may have to tone down my internal sense of spirituality to fit in with my external adolescent peers who are doing something very different. There was in the U.S. In 2005 a huge study of youth and religion. It was over 3,000 individuals from across the country, not Jewish children in particular, but there were not a from sample, but there were Jewish children represented. And the study is really quite striking, because it found, despite what people anticipated, this was 2005, that religion was a significant factor in the lives of American teens. That the vast majority of them said it's a significant presence in our life. The vast majority were neither alienated nor rebellious when it came to religious involvement. And the vast majority followed in their parents' footsteps and felt positive about religion. They reported that they saw numerous advantages that religion offers, both them as an individual and society as a whole. Interestingly, in spite of saying all this good stuff about religion, most of them described their religious connection and content as kind of unfocused and kind of implicit in their lives, kind of like the furniture. It's there, but I don't really do much about it or take much notice of it. Now, granted, again, this is not a Jewish sample, but it was very interesting to consider this. And most adolescents seemed, in this sample of over 3,000, seemed to subscribe to something called the moralistic therapeutic deism. That is a replacing substantive religious faith traditions with the following. A God exists, and that God created and orders the world and watches over human life. God wants us to be good. That's paradigm number two. Nice and fair. The way that the Bible says and most world religions tell us to be. This is very important. The predominant belief, 2005 adolescents, of their religious tenet is the central goal of life is to be happy and feel good about oneself. I thought that's, you know, a very interesting popular psychology. It's like the Psychology Today version of the Bible. Be happy, you know. God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when needed to resolve a problem, and good people go to heaven. That was the adolescent, you know, sum total, or the commonalities of adolescent belief, which if you think about it is a pretty primitive and poor watering down of all that certainly Yiddishkeit and Jewish spirituality and religious culture have to offer. Just one word about, you know, women versus men, and we'll talk about moms and dads also a little bit later. Women are generally both more religious and more spiritual than men. In psychological studies, as is also in our heritage, we have many understandings of some of the different obligations of women and men in terms of an understanding in Jewish thought that women are inherently blessed with greater spiritual nature. Psychological theorists have posited that this may be because many religions contain what are called feminine characteristics, things like gentleness, submissiveness to a higher authority, and nurturance, and that's more female-friendly than the male, macho, Super Bowl, let's kill him way of being. Okay, go Giants. Okay, I have to put in my one little plug for, you know, anyway. So how do, when we think about all of that, how do we as adults influence child spirituality? And remind me, if I forget, to get back to the Israel study and how children influence our spirituality, because it is really an ever, I don't want to say it's an endless loop, it's a spiral. Parents, by the way, matter the most. We don't think it, because they don't let us know that. They don't say, oh, by the way, your spirituality is really important to me. I'm really noticing your religious practice. This matters. They don't tell you. As a matter of fact, often they tell you it doesn't matter. All of the research says that the single most important social influence on children's religious and spiritual lives is their parents. We make a huge difference. most adolescents are neither reflective or appreciative of this fact. They do not thank us for the extra moments we take when we benchlecht that we really have kavana. They don't say, I'm so glad you sent me to yeshiva or to, you know, Talmud Torah. I'm really glad you gave me that. We will not get the thanks. But the best predictor of what a child will look like spiritually and religiously is looking at the family that they come from. Mothers and fathers do play very different roles in shaping children's religious affiliation and their patterns of religious involvement. Fathers seem to play a very significant role in structuring sons' religious belief and religious involvement. Mothers play a central role in how sons apply the principles of religion in their daily life. Years and years ago, I heard T. Barry Brazelton, he's a wonderful pediatrician, give a grand rounds presentation about the differences in parenting between moms and dads, that dads tend to be much more roughhousing and get much more kind of down and dirty and involved with their kids in that way, and mothers are more kind of giving the broad, overarching lessons. And his understanding of this was that, you know, for mothers, for 9 months, the child has used you as their personal playground. For the 9 months of gestation, they've bumped you, they've nudged you, they've made, you know, their presence very much known. So that once the child is born, all roughhousing and that kind of tough play is now dad's job. You want somebody's body to torment, make it daddy's, not mine. In terms of religious development, I'm not exactly sure why we have this kind of dichotomy. But you have, I think I gave you on the source sheets, I don't know if you have this wonderful quote. If not, I'll read it to you. No, I didn't put it there. Okay, so I'll share it with you. But a wonderful quote from the Rav out of his tribute to the Rebbetzin of Tain. It's just such a beautiful discussion of the different ways that he was influenced by his... Oh, it is there? Okay. So you do have it. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. She talked to me in Yana Diyom. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sedra every Friday night. Most of all, I learned that, he talks about what he learned from his mother and from his father. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there's a flavor, a scent, a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The fathers knew much about the Shabbat. The mothers lived the Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers learned the halacha with us. The mothers made the halacha a life. They gave us the flavors, the smells, the nuance. They literally, what do mothers do? We feed your kishkas. We get it in your kishkas. We may not be so specific about do this, do that, although my children will tell you I'm pretty specific about do this, do that, and we're very good at nagging, but we also are the ones who create the family atmosphere. So we need to think about that in our families, and as we're raising our children, are we giving them both the specifics and the tam? Are we giving the atmosphere as well as the direct guidance? And perhaps in our more modern and egalitarian and liberated families, maybe we can even take some turns and let Abbas and dads share some of the warmth and the flavor and nuance as well, and not have it only be women. We know that we can't have one size fits all in Jewish education, and we can't have one size fits all in spiritual education. So the Chozev Lublin on the multiple pathways to spirituality says it's impossible to tell people what way they should take. We can't tell everyone this is what you should do to be a spiritual person. For one way to serve God is through learning, another through prayer, another through fasting, and still another through eating. Diametrically opposed possibilities. Everyone should carefully observe what way his heart draws him to, and then choose his way with all his strength. we have this dialectic in Jewish education all the time, particularly for boys' education. How much should be Gemara-based? How much should be brisker and should be logic? And how much should be transcendent and the spirituality and hashkafa? And the answer, I think one of the reasons we're stuck is, the answer is it depends on the child. That what works so well as the pathway to learning and to spirituality, this is something that was found in the Israel study. They were very shocked by this finding, by the way. When you asked people who said, I have definitely become a more spiritual and religious being, and you asked them, what was the vehicle? What led you there? They were very surprised in the Israel study that there was a subset of people who said it wasn't the touchy-feely kumbaya moments on the shores of the Kinneret as we made Havdalah. It wasn't, you know, sitting with all the girls from seminary as we daven together with such meaning by the Kotel. For some students, what did they say was the pathway to their growth? Learning. It was sitting over Gemara. It was struggling with a hard Rashi and Chumash. It was the act of sitting in a base medrash and learning. So for some, the pathway is study. For others, the pathway is experience. And we can't say, this is the kivun, this is it, because everyone's different and we have to respect that we're dealing with very, very different students. We also, I think, have to respect that spirituality is something that is best nurtured very gently, very carefully, and sometimes remotely at a distance or with some time away. And again, I don't remember which quotes I wound up putting on here, but crashing through the, if we want to support, it's the top of the second page. This wonderful quote by Palmer on teaching, and particularly teaching tefillah and teaching meaningful prayer. If we want to support each other's inner lives, we have to remember a simple truth. The human soul does not want to be fixed. It simply wants to be seen and heard. If we want to see and hear a person's soul, there is another truth we must remember. The soul is like a wild animal, tough, resilient, and yet shy. When we go crashing through the woods, shouting for it to come out so we can help it, the soul retreats. It will stay in hiding. But if we're willing to sit quietly and wait for a while, the soul may show itself. What is the equivalent of the crashing through the woods? It's, to me, the equivalent is going into a day school, and I visit day schools all across the country, going into a day school or a teen minion or youth minion and having somebody walk up and down the aisles and say, Etz Ba'al HaMakom, come on, David, let's go. Come on, we're on a lane, let's go. Come on, keep the positive. Where's the soul going? That is not a quiet invitation. That's pushing particularly a frightened soul or a fragile soul as far away as possible. We need to give children time and space. Very interesting. I saw a focus group of Jewish educators and a focus group of Jewish teens were asked, and I'll share with you some of their suggestions, you know, what should we do about tefillah in Jewish schools? What should we do about prayer? And one suggestion, which I thought was just absolutely brilliant, of one of the teens was, do not schedule class immediately after davening. Give us a 10-minute buffer. Why? Because he said he can't daven. He knows he's getting a late mark if he doesn't finish his, you know, davening on time and get to his locker and get his books and get to his first period class. He's getting a mark against him. 3 marks, he gets detention. He gets detention, he misses basketball practice. So he is spending his entire time in davening not thinking about davening. What's he thinking about? Got to finish. Bell's going to ring. This is not a way to daven. It's not a way to teach kavanah. So simple little things that they're not so simple because it's always challenging with a day school schedule to try to make time. But simple things about recognizing that some people need more space and more time. And that we really have to think about courting the neshamas of the children that we're attempting to build spirituality with rather than going out after them. Kessler, one of the leading writers and researchers, talks about five pathways to spirituality. And I'm going to go over all of them. A deep connection, silence and stillness, meaning and purpose, joy and transcendence. So What do we mean by deep connection? We know that one of the most important pathways to spirituality is through spiritual people, through spiritual role models, to seeing and witnessing people who have somehow succeeded in living meaningful, spiritual, purposeful lives. One of the things we have to know about, particularly about adolescence, when spiritual development is so important, is that adolescents have an incredibly sensitive nose to sniff out hypocrisy. If you do not walk the walk and talk, you know, if you talk the talk but don't walk the walk, they'll know it. If you talk about being a spiritual person and you're davening with incredible kavana, and then you go into the hallway and you humiliate students, or if you take cell phones or you're texting while you're davening, or Rebbe or Mora is doing it in davening, you cannot be a spiritual role model. You can't be. They will, and everything good about you, by the way, will be negated. Everything that they respect about you will now be washed away, because in an adolescent's mind, hypocrisy is the central, it's the central crime. And once you've committed that crime, you're of no value to me. You are not my role model. So we need to really look at ourselves as parents, as educators, as members of the community, and say, we can't talk about the importance of living a spiritual life and then talk Lashon Hara during shul. We shouldn't be talking it after shul, out of shul, before shul, but certainly in the middle of davening. You know, how can we do that? And we can't talk about, I spoke last night about inclusivity, we can't talk about, we believe in the value of every human being, we're all B'Tselem Elohim, and only certain B'Tselem Elohims get invited to our Shabbos table. If we're going to live that message, if we're going to speak that message, we have to live it. We have to think about how large is our tent? How welcoming and open are we if we want to imbue that with our children? For the silence and stillness, this is so hard. I know I struggle with it enormously, and I think it's only getting harder. We know that spirituality and a concept that we have in psychology called mindfulness, which it's a very new, fashionable concept, but it's really kavana. It's and it, very interesting. Years ago, I went to a seminar on happiness, and you know, can you imagine this? They convene a whole bunch of psychologists and Jewish educators to decide, are Jewish kids happy? And it was cross denominational. So there were people from the conservative movement, the reform movement, egalitarian, reconstructions. Everybody was around the table asking questions about are Jewish children happy? But one segment of the researchers at the table had proposed that they do extensive studying of Buddhist monks. They were going to go off to, I don't know where Buddhist monks are, on some mountaintop in Tibet. Is that right? Buddhists are in Tibet? Did I get the right denomination? And they're going to go hook them up to electrodes and find their mindful centers, because they're really good at, apparently, at emptying their mind and focus and focused meditation and all that stuff. And they're thinking that, you know, this is a Buddhist concept. Mindfulness is a, and I'm thinking, last I checked, we have kavana. We, you know, you don't have to go far afield to come to a Jewish understanding of mindfulness and focus and intent and being able, the Rambam writes about it, there are endless Jewish sources on what is required to focus oneself, to clear one's mind, and to be truly in the moment of one's tefillah, or in the moment of doing a mitzvah, so that you are not, yeah, I'm going through the motions. Did I, you know, it's kind of like, how many times do you leave your house and say, did I lock the door? That's the typical example of the lack of mindfulness. It's because you weren't at all attending to what you were doing in the moment that you locked the door. And so 2 minutes later, you can't remember whether you did it or not. Had you been mindful, had you said, okay, I am now focusing on my key in the lock, on turning it, putting it into my pocket. Nothing else is in my head while I do this. I'm bracketing this moment. Well, that's the exact same phenomena that happens to us half the time that we're davening Aleinu or Ashrei or Shema. That it's like, did I say that? Did I say that bracha? Did I make... Did I make the bracha for this? Did I say Bracha Achrona? Did I not? We can't remember because we didn't bracket it. We didn't stop ourselves. We didn't, and this is part of the problem, we didn't turn off the BlackBerry, silence the phone, not talk to the 12 people, the different body parts that are beeping, ringing, buzzing, vibrating, you know. I love it. Everybody now has, it's the pocket vibration phenomena. You know, there's a whole generation of people that are walking around going, rrr, 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 you know, just one side of their body is constantly vibrating. But we need to teach kids how to do this and how to just be still, to focus and frame their thoughts. And all the research suggests that this is getting harder and that our brains are changing. I went to a dinner at YU of new faculty when I first started there a couple of years ago at the president's house, a lovely dinner, faculty, new faculty from the law school, the medical school, everyone. So I happened to be sitting at a table with an ophthalmology researcher from Einstein Medical School. And he said that they are changing the standards of vision because the shape of children's eyeballs has changed over the past 20 years. What changes the shape of eyeballs? He says, video games, exposure at young ages to small screens. The norm, the new norms of vision and of human development are different because of how much we are exposing kids. And there's no question that cognitively what we're doing in terms of the way children think and the way they focus is being changed forever by all our attachment to electronic devices. You know, I used to think that, well, at least we have Shabbos and we're unplugged for Shabbos. And you know, I see heads nodding because it's been called and referenced in, you know, in writings now, the half Shabbos phenomena. To me, I don't think you, I mean, in my mind, it's either Shabbos or it's not Shabbos. Once it's not Shabbos, it's not Shabbos. But it does speak to the adolescent brain, which is now saying, if I text on Shabbos, only because I have to, because it would so interfere with my hana, my ability to enjoy Shabbos, and it would also cause something in the adolescent lingo that's called FOMO, fear of missing out, F-O-M-O, that if I don't access my text messages on Shabbos, and I find out that everybody was at Novik's house for Shabbos, and I missed it, I didn't look in my cell phone, that I'm going to miss out on this incredible social opportunity. So I must text. I must text on Shabbos. And, you know, my feeling is the next step will be, well, if I texted on Shabbos and I find out that everybody is two towns over, then I got to get on a bus on Shabbos. And if I'm going to get, you know, it's a pretty slippery slope. But if you ask the adolescents who are engaging in this, they will tell you that they still consider themselves Shomer Shabbos. This is just something that they feel is part of their Shabbos observance. So the adolescent brain has this ability to to live with their own hypocrisy, but not to tolerate our hypocrisy. But helping them understand the importance of mindfulness, the true pleasure of mindfulness, the absolute wonder. It feels great when you can just focus on one thing. We've become incessant multitaskers. And it really is nice when we can just chill and really enjoy one thing and not have 20 things. Meaning and purpose is also something that mindfulness helps, because it's very hard to reflect on your purpose in life and the bigger questions if you're running around multitasking your way through life. You need time to reflect. I also think that one of the incredible gifts of the year in Israel, and that it's called the gap year in the secular world. Some kids take it not to go to a year in Israel, but to go to the Peace Corps or to go do volunteer work. But the wonderful gift of this gap year, if we can afford to give it to children, is that it gives them literally a time out from the rat race that started in kindergarten. Well, if I don't do well here, then I'm not going to get into that elementary school. If I don't get into that elementary, then I won't get into that. And then if I won't get into the seminary I want, then I won't get into the high school, then the college. I mean, literally, I'm getting complaints from first grade teachers about the pressure that's being exerted on them to meet curricular demands so that children will be in their right place for eighth grade. First grade and kindergarten teachers are complaining about the downward demands that are being placed on them. Helping children find and adolescents find meaning and purpose in their life is an incredible, it's incredible joy, but it's also, it's not easy. The joy is that adolescence is a time when causes and worldwide and large concerns become very relevant. Children in their adolescent years are looking for things to help them, to excite them. They're looking to make a difference in the world. And so when you get them engaged and involved in something, and they say, oh, you know, I can make a difference. YU has wonderful programs. I feel like I'm doing a commercial, but they have their wonderful, the Center for Jewish Future sponsors, you know, go to Nicaragua and build a school over winter break. Go to New Orleans after the hurricane and help families rebuild houses. And kids do this on their winter break instead of going skiing or to Florida and sunning on the beaches. One of our sons had the bracha to do one of the trips. It's a life-changing experience. You feel very clearly that, wow, there's a meaning and a purpose to life beyond my four walls and, you know, what, getting the latest gadget and going on dates and that kind of stuff and winning basketball or Super Bowl championships. You know, there's other things in life to live for. Joy. The fourth of the pathways to spirituality is joy. How we model joy and how we encourage joy, I also think is critical. That we have to be open at sharing our joyfulness in very genuine ways, not in, there's a practice in New York, I don't know if it's done here, but a lot of the simchas for kids, you know, bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, they hire what I would call joy facilitators. You know, they used to be professional mourners. These are professional joyers. You know, there are a couple of guys, and they're wonderful. They're actually wonderful. They get the kids all, you know, engaged in it. They wear funny tuxedos, and they teach them all dance steps. It's very nice. I, in a wistful way, I wish kids could just get into the circle with the Baal Simcha and be joyful. I wish we could do that, and I hope that we show, that we model when we go to a Simcha, not, oh, I got to go into the dance, I got to go, come on, go into the circle. You know, and there's like, it's like, where is the Simcha here? It's like, I'm required to do three steps. I did my bit. Now I'm going to go schmooze with friends. The idea of a simcha is to be besimcha. And we have to model that. And we have to show it. And we have to show that we're comfortable with it so that adolescents who spend half of their life looking over their shoulder and seeing what everybody else is doing can feel their level of comfort with it. And we do have to give them safe places to be joyful and time. You know, we have to make the chagiga in a way that it's not, okay, you have 3 minutes of the, you know, Hanukkah chagiga, and now it's SAT prep. You know, it's really hard to be joyous when there's 18 tests and 4 things hanging over your head. So you have to think about that. And now transcendence. I want to talk about transcendence. We were just had the good fortune to be in Israel for a few weeks. And did some quite amazing hikes and experiences. I'm a sucker. I am a sucker for nature. You put me on top of a cliff. Hopefully I drove there and I'm not, you know, rappelling. But, you know, you get me up someplace with an amazing vista. That's it. I don't need Jewish tomes on Hashkafa. There is a God. I'm fine. This is good. You know, you give me a sunrise. You give me, we went to the Hula Nature Reserve and saw flocks of birds. You give me wildlife. That does it for me. Does it for me. Everybody has their own pathway. For some, it may be different. But nature does play a large role for many in transcendence. Louvre, in a 2008 publication called The Last Child in the Woods, talks about what he calls denatured childhood. We have denatured childhood. We have put childhood in front of TV. We have put childhood in movie theaters and bowling alleys. And he says it's our responsibility to renature children. that they need to have returning experiences within the natural world in order to understand their place in it, in order to understand the transcendent splendor of the universe. And a wonderful poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Aurora Leigh, this is an excerpt. She writes, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries and daub their natural faces unaware. God's wonders are everywhere, but we need the stillness and the time. We have to expose children to it, but we also need to give them the time." Again, it can't be, we're doing a 20-mile hike, come on, now let's march. The hike needs to have moments of stillness. It needs to have, we need to take them quietly into the woods and let them sit and let them reflect and let them just be. Let me talk a little bit about prayer, because you can't talk about transcendence without talking about tefillah. And, you know, one can argue that the goal of tefillah is transcendence. It is to have some personal communion or experience of the divine through prayer, is one of the purposes. Prayer, by the way, is a universal practice. It doesn't look the same in every religion, but the notion of some type of communication or connection with the divine is a universal phenomena. Women and the elderly pray more than men and the young. People are also more likely to engage in and utilize prayer as a coping mechanism, not surprisingly, in times of stress or challenge. The Rambam in Hilchos Tefillah talks about how we can quiet the mind before tefillah. He asks, how does one concentrate? What constitutes proper intentions? One should empty his heart of all foreign thoughts and view himself as standing in front of the Shekhinah, of God's holy presence, divine presence. Therefore, one must settle in a little before the tefillah in order to enable his heart to concentrate and thereafter pray in peace and supplication. Again, I spend a lot of time in day schools. A lot of times, I'm arriving to a day school, yeshiva, the same time everyone else is, as the buses or carpools are disgorging their passengers. There are knapsacks flying everywhere, and usually they are dumped. And through incredible tumult and noise, people are making themselves to their way to wherever davening happens in that morning. They're coming in at all different stages, coats and zippers and backpacks and lunch bags. There may be, the Baal Tefillah has already started, maybe they're not starting, there may be an army of shushers walking up and down, telling everyone to get ready. But this is not what I see as Rambam saying, standing in front of the Shekhinah. It doesn't feel to me like we give our students a context. I remember many, many, many years ago, I can't remember who gave me this gift. I don't remember which teacher or Shabbaton facilitator did it. But they blocked off the entrance to where we were davening. I think it was a Shabbaton, I don't remember. They blocked off and kept us all outside. And they said, "You are about to meet an extraordinarily important monarch. You are about to meet a king. You're going to enter the chamber of the king. How do you want to be seen? How are you going to walk in?" I mean, this is an important person's inner chambers. It's their inner sanctum. How are you going to carry yourself? And think carefully about what you're going to say. They then opened the doors, and of course, we were teenagers. We all were like, who's in there? Who's going to be there? We didn't get it quite yet. But we all went in, and we all, you know, took our seats very quietly. And then he went on to explain the structure of tefillot in terms of how one would approach a great king. That one would not start off by saying, listen, could you spare me some, you know, could you give me, could you get me? That what do you say when you first meet a person of greatness? You acknowledge the greatness. You say songs of, you know, songs of thanks and praise. That's where you start.
And I say it was an incredible gift because it totally changed the way I thought about tefillah from that point forward. It gave me a context. And I find so often in Jewish education, we teach the content without the context. We teach, here's the ashrei, not where does it sit in the davening? Why does it happen here? Why am I saying it? What does it mean? Where did it come from? Do you know how many Jewish day school students we ask questions of time and context, and they totally believe that Rambam was around while the First Temple was burning, which happened about the same time that Germany occupied, you know, and built the camps. And there's no, every room has to have a timeline. Every room has to have a way that children understand, by the way, that our Jewish history on a timeline is this big, and the modern American history that they know is the tiniest little part of it. That we as a people, as a culture, as a nation, our tefillot and our heritage go so far beyond anything in this country. They have such more depth and meaning. But without that graphic on the wall, they think, yeah, around when Columbus sailed. You know, that's when the temple was destroyed. It's like a further back, a little further back. They don't have the idea. So we have to give the context. We have to, if we want quiet before tefillah, if we want mindfulness before tefillah, we have to help our children understand what tefillah is. That it is our personal opportunity to have an audience with the King, to have an audience with the divine. It's our personal connection. I told this story last night or the other, I don't remember, when we went to Israel for the first time with our children. Our youngest son was 8. And he was, you know, we totally gave him a context for writing the petek that you put in the kotel, that the kotel is such a makom kavod, it's such a place of holiness, and that our tefillot from that place have a special value for Hashem, and you write it, and he wrote his petek, and he, you know, curled it up, and he went with his Abba to put it in the kotel. He puts it in the kotel, and 2 seconds later, it was 8. He said, okay, can we go around the back now and see Hashem read it? We have mail slots in my neighborhood. So if you put it in, you could go see it drop on the other side. His notion was, if my tefillot are going yashar shamayim, I want to see the end result. So we do have to be careful that while we give children a context and an understanding, that we also ground it in reality. It's a gut-wrenching story. There was a class in a boys' yeshiva day school. They were, I think, third graders, and the father of one of the third grade boys was very ill and was having open heart surgery. So the Rav, as anyone would expect, said to the boys, we're going to say Tehillim for one of our Talmidim's fathers. They said Tehillim, Baruch Hashem, he came out of surgery beautifully, and they celebrated that their Tehillim were answered, their prayers were answered. Unfortunately, it was Nifter a day later. And a day later, the Rav has to now, if your context is that there's a direct connection, the Kotel, we put the prayer in, Hashem reads it on the other side, we daven, someone gets healthy, our prayers were answered. If you're going to give that simplistic understanding for the context of prayer, then you're going to be doing damage control because life is so much more complex. And the great divine King does not share with us his plan. And so we daven to ask that, you know, hopefully our chelek, our little piece of wisdom that we're offered is enough to get us through life, but not that we're asking today, could I please, you know, not hit traffic on the way to the airport? And I don't hit traffic. Aha, my prayers were answered. It's not like that. We have to help our students also understand that we're davening for broader goals. I always think in terms of I'm davening that I should have the sechel to be able to daven well. That's what I'm davening for. And the other thing that I experience all the time in terms of tefillah, I have a small specialty in my clinical practice. I see a lot of obsessive, compulsive, and anxious children. And it is religious practice is very hard for children who are obsessive. Because the same way I said, you know, did I lock the door? Well, if you're an obsessive person, you not only have that little nagging sense, did I lock the door? Did I daven the Amida? Did I say all the brachas correctly? Did I have kavana? But you have, if you could imagine, an unbelievably powerful urge to go back and correct it, and a horrific, powerful feeling that if I don't, something terrible is going to happen. And because so much of our teachings and our rituals are around, okay, do this, do this, do this, do this, and do it exactly right, and be machmir, and it's very careful, for obsessive kids, it's really hard. So one thing that I have found over the years in talking with obsessive kids about tefillah is that you have to recognize that even the greatest sages in the world, even our great Gedolei Hador and the Gedolim of the previous generations, they didn't stop davening. They didn't say, oh, I did it perfect. I don't need to put on tefillin anymore. I did it great. My davening is now fine. I'm on a great religious stance. I don't need Yom Kippur this year. No problem. That even the Gedolim recognized that tefillah is part of an ongoing process of spiritual development, and it's never finished. I want to wrap up and say that we have some pressures that work against us on a community level, not just on an individual level. We have a pressure to get more content in education, to have students who know more when they graduate, not who are more when they graduate. And we need to think about that focus. We need to think about cookie cutter. The problem with cookie cutter approaches is that it means that we're going to have kids who don't fit in our tent and who feel miserable and left out. And the broader, the bigger our tray of Danishes and the more types of cookies we can have, the more likelihood that every child will feel welcomed and will belong. A high school student, it's a quote from a high school student. You can think that all Jews are together and care about one another, and then you see something like Madoff, and it makes me feel betrayed. When religious people don't live up to standards, there was a big fight in my shul, and people did bad things. I see the fight between Zionists and Naturi Karta, and it's not what Jews should be doing. If in the Israeli Day Parade, they protest and we scream back, what good is that? We need to keep peace because we're still brothers. Judaism shouldn't be like that. We need to look on a community level at how we're sending out olive branches and how we're sending the message that we can be spiritually connected. And before I close with a quote from a real giant on Super Bowl Sunday, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I'll just share with you that our findings in the Israel study of parents whose children came back from the year in Israel was that, A, children were remarkably and wonderfully impacted both religiously and spiritually by the experience, but not drastically so. They made small and logical increments in their, by their parents' report, in their religiosity. No parent who responded said that their child's religious change had been done in a way that was disrespectful or alienating to their family, which I found amazing. Because the word on the street is, oh my gosh, your kids are going to flip, they're going to frum out, they won't eat in your kitchen, they won't do this, they won't... Not one parent on our survey, we had 150 parents, responded. None of them said it's bad. It caused problems in the home. It was done in a disrespectful way. And half of the parents that we surveyed said, I have become a more spiritual person because of the changes in my child. The year in Israel's not just, our children's spirituality is not just changing them, it's changing us. So Jonathan Sacks says on this, you know, as we just finished Shabbat Shira, that faith is more like music than like science. Science analyzes, music integrates, and as music connects note to note, so faith connects episode to episode, life to life, age to age, in a timeless melody that breaks into time. God is the composer and librettist. We are each called on to be voices in the choir, singers of God's song. Faith teaches us to hear the music beneath the noise. But he goes on, our generation needs new songs so that we too can sing joyously to God as our ancestors did at Kriyat Yam Suf. And when they emerged, the other side free at last. Because when the soul sings, the spirit soars. Thank you all so much.
Thank you again to Dr. Novick. Before we take a brief 2-minute break, we're going to have a short public service announcement from our president, Dr. Hogan.
Thanks, Sam. I'm hoping you'll be my little focus group for the next 6 weeks. I'm going on the stump for the COLEL. This past Wednesday, 8 years after it began, Facebook filed documents for its initial public offering. With over 800 million users and an anticipated value of over $10 billion, it's easy to measure Facebook's success. It's been just over 3 years since our startup, Chicago's YU Tormentium COLEL, began its public offerings. And the question is, how do we measure our success? Some say it's the increased Torah learning taking place in every shul and school our hashkafa is taught. Some say it's our ability each year to make further inroads in significant reducing our deficit. Personally, I think it's the retention of COLEL fellows in Chicago. In the long run, are we building a critical mass of people in our community that will make Chicago a destination that attracts our children and grandchildren? Since last year's dinner, our success is quantifiable. Three fellows matriculated our program this year. One, Rabbi Noah Barone, has become a teacher at Akiva Schechter. Rabbi Morty Turoff is at Ida Crown. And Rabbi Michael Teicher is enrolled at grad school in Loyola. In addition to their positions, all three continue to make time to learn with members of our community. Also, regarding retention, I might add Rabbi Brand's contract was renewed for an additional 3 years. Our critical mass is growing. Twice a year, we come to you asking you to make a meaningful gift while allowing you to define the word meaningful. If your meaningful gift is $18, we need it. If your meaningful gift is $18,000, and we recently picked up our fifth gift at or above that category, we need it. Today, to make your meaningful gift twice as meaningful, we have what they call on public television a matching grant. Members of our board have agreed to match any new or increased Kol Yom Rishon pledges from $18 up to $10,000. As anticipated, our direct financial subsidy from Yeshiva University has ended. President Joel told me, "We love the Kolel, and we hope Chicago loves the Kolel, but if it is to continue, Chicago must sustain it." So please consider attending our dinner, and if you have a bit of chutzpah, take a lawn sign. And of course, please consider making a meaningful gift that will be matched to maintain and sustain our Kolel for many years to come. Now back to your regularly scheduled program.
Halftime show. People want to grab a drink or go to the bathroom very quickly, then we'll start with Rabbi Engel.
There are cards on the tables outside.
Did we get that on?
People from his school.